Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Back.
I have to move this a little higher. Is it on? Does that work? Okay. Thank you very much, Daryl, for that kind introduction. And before I start, I'd like to make a few comments. Yes, it is. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. Before I get started, I would like to introduce, actually, and mention the team at Cornell that has been involved with the work that I'm going to talk about. Luis Tedeschi and Michael Baker, and they're here to answer all your hard questions. So any hard ones that you have, we'll refer to them. This has truly been a team effort, the work that I'm going to show you. And I can remember a lot of team efforts in my life, beginning back on the farm. Now, back on the farm, we always thought having a mix of the older folks and the younger folks in multi-generational farms were very good. And in some cases, though, it turned out that the older folks, as they run out of energy, had all the vision and money and had the younger folks to do all the work. And I kind of remember it that way. In science, the way I look at it now is probably my greatest contribution to our effort is as a historical perspective. We need the younger folks coming on with all the new, fresh ideas, and I'm finding that it's harder and harder to learn new things, even though I like to continue to learn. So I'm very grateful to Luis and Mike's input and contribution to our work. Okay, let's get started with this and whole issue of post-weaning feed efficiency. And let's first talk about how economically important this is to the feedlot industry that we select for more efficient animals. Not easy to do, and Tom, you did just what you thought, what you said you were going to do. You left us with some hard things to address that it's very complicated to try to select for it. But let's back up and say, what is the economic advantage to a feedlot, the feedlot industry, of having more efficient animals? And then let's talk about whether there are ways available to us today, knowing new techniques are coming down the road. Well, what tools do we have now that we can use today in models to try to identify those animals that have improved feed efficiency? Well, if we take an average steer that finishes now at about 1,170 pounds in the feedlot industry, that gains 3.21 and eats 18.7 pounds of dry matter a day, with a feed efficiency of 5.82 and a profit, let's say, of $65, okay, just using that as a basis of comparison. If we were able to take that same animal or a mate and we were able to get them to eat 10% more feed, okay, and therefore increase their feed-to-gain ratio from 5.82 to 5.67, we would increase profitability about 18%. And the reason that animal had a better feed efficiency was what? We kept the composition the same now. We finished him at 1170 to low choice grade. So we didn't change composition. Let's make that assumption. What we did is we simply got them to eat more feed over their maintenance requirement and diluted the maintenance requirement out, right? I think that goes back to a basic concept that Tom talked about. Now, if we could go a step further, and we could take that same animal, get them to eat the same amount of feed, okay, but they would digest and or metabolize those nutrients consumed more efficiently, our feed-to-gain ratio would improve to 5.18, and we'd improve profitability 43%. Okay, so there's a huge opportunity here. There's a huge impact, and Tom talked about there is variation out there. The problem is, how do we do this without changing body composition? Because we do have a window of acceptability in terms of carcass sizes. We know that. And we have a window of acceptability in terms of quality grade that people are willing. And we'll come back to that in just a minute. Okay, so how do we measure feed efficiency? Let's get right down to it. Given the tools available to you on your farms. Now, I'm going to talk about at the farm level, at the feedlot level. What can we do today to try to measure feed efficiency? Okay. The first thing is we could individually feed all the animals, right? And all the bulls that you test on your own farms or ranches or progeny that we put in feedlots, we could individually feed them, right? And then we could measure the composition with ultrasound or some other method and try to compare them to the same stage of growth. And we probably could get at this, but it's not practical, right? Let's face it right now. And remember when we start talking about residual feed intake too, And the studies that have been done as a research tool, it involves individual feeding and being able to compare the feed efficiency relative to regression equation across those individually fed. And so there's one thing to talk about these tools, and then we have to think about how do we translate those into a methodology that you can use on your farm that's practical, okay, when you can individually feed. So that's what we're going to focus on. Given all the flaws, and I'm going to point out the flaws and approach we take, the goal is to have a tool you can use today on your farm or ranch under practical conditions when animals are pen fed, okay? That's our underlying assumption today of what our focus is. Okay, the second thing we can do is we can select for growth rate alone, right? If you have a scales or access to a scales, you can select for growth rate alone. You measure the beginning, the post-weaning weight. You measure their weight at finish. You get their daily gain. And then just select for growth, right? And as Tom mentioned, we've been there. We've done that. What do we end up with? We end up with bigger cattle. The ones that gained the fastest were bigger. But they also had a higher maintenance requirement. So several studies have shown us that, in fact, we did not improve feed efficiency by just selecting for growth rate alone. We end up primarily with bigger cattle, because that approach doesn't account for difference in mature size or composition of gain. So let's say for the moment that doesn't work, although we're going to come back with a twist on measuring growth rate alone that might help us on that one, take a little different approach that Earl Crossman talked about in 1870, and maybe somebody before him talked about using metabolic body size as a way to do that over the same stage of growth. But at any rate, let's assume for the moment that's not going to work for us to get at true feed efficiency, where we don't change weight at a target composition. The third thing we can do, and this is what we're going to talk about now in the work that we have done, is we can measure daily gain, we can measure the growth of the animals, and we have tools now we can get at what the composition of that animal is, even if in herd replacement we don't slaughter using ultrasound. And therefore get at what the composition of gain is, so use their growth rate and their expected finished weight at a target fat, and use net energy values, metabolizable energy values, for maintenance and growth, and simply then, based on the observed weight and growth rate in the feedlot, determine their feed for maintenance plus feed for growth divided by daily gain would give us feed efficiency, okay? Now, I hope this stimulates some discussion, but I'm going to repeat myself. I just want to give you where we're headed. This is the concept that we have been following on how we could go about this, assuming, again, we can individually feed the animals on typical practical situations to get at feed efficiency. Okay, now in order to do this, there are several variables that we've got to be able to account for, and we're going to talk about what those variables are and how we account for those in our model. Number one is we got to be able to account for the expected weight at the target composition. Okay, when you're evaluating herd replacements like bulls and heifers, you got to have some projection of what weight that animal will be at the target fat at which we market cattle, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. We've got to know the net energy content of gain, because if you just select for growth alone and you end up with faster growing animals that lay down less fat, then despite the war on fat, which we're going to talk about a couple of different times in this presentation, we still have the best market, get the highest price for those animals that have a certain amount of fat, right? So we're likely to have to consider composition of gain. And then we need to know the energy content, energy required for maintenance of the animal, or at least some estimate of it. And we know at least need to know their body weight. And then we know that varies. It's tough to get at that variation in maintenance requirement under practical feeding conditions. But at least body weight accounts for a lot of it, which we'll talk about a little bit too. And then diet energy values. Okay, so those are things that we need to be able to measure under practical conditions, if we're going to get out feed efficiency. And these are measurable things. Not necessarily easy, but these are things we know we can do because we are doing this. Okay? So what I'm going to talk about the rest of the presentation then
is I thought that it would be most useful to you to talk about how we can put this together in a working model that you can use on the farm or in the feedlot to try to account for these variables. And I'll talk about the model that we've developed to achieve that. And our goal is to be able to take pin-fed individual animals and to be able to compute their individual cost to gain and feed efficiency using measuring those variables that we talked about. And the model I'm talking about is Daryl, in his very nice introduction, indicates that we are using in several programs in the field. Microbeef Technologies, Matt Travey is here, are using this approach as well as Future Beef. And a number of retained ownership programs are using this approach as well. Okay, so now let's talk about how we get at some of these underlying inputs that we have to be able to do this. The first thing we have to do, and always keep in mind, is you first have to understand what our target is in terms of composition. You cannot be comparing apples and oranges. You've got to compare apples and apples. You've got to compare animals over the same stage of growth at the same composition if you want to try to identify those that are different in feed efficiency. And so that's the first critical point. And with all the talk about leaner beef and the war on fat, the realities are, if we look at taste panel work, and these are a summary of body composition studies that we have done over the years, in which we've also had, we've had taste panel data as well as measured empty body fat and the quality grade. And here's the number of animals that we had measured of diverse breed types at each of these quality grades. And here's the body fat they turned out to be. Okay, and notice that there are significant differences in empty body fat at the different grades as there are in taste panel scores and the percent that's unacceptable from a taste standpoint. So, in my mind, it's pretty clear today why we still target choice grade. Because there are fewer percentage that are unacceptable from a consumer standpoint. Despite the war on fat, that's what people are still wanting to eat. Perhaps they'll eat less of it, but what they do eat, they want that consuming fat. We won't get into all the reasons, whether taste, it depends on fat and juice and all the variables are. But this is just the way the data works out, okay? Okay, now, I have to show this. There's going to continue to be pressure on fat, okay? But we get a lot of bad press. This is a front page of the New York Times magazine. I don't know how many of you have heard about the article that they did last spring about following a steer through the feedlot that created a great uproar. Well, now you've got to read this one, folks, because this one will actually make you feel the opposite. It'll make you feel better about our industry, and maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel. So get last Sunday, New York Times Magazine. We copied that, and it's some good reading. What if fat doesn't make you fat? And the target is animal fat. And what happened is the war on fat got started back in late 70s without a good scientific basis. And this writer went back and talked to a lot of different scientists and tried to get at the origins of the war on fat and why animal fat has been targeted and why in the face of targeting animal fat we continue to get more and more obese in this country and why people continue to get obese. And the bottom line is when we had the war on fat, We put less pressure on eating animal fat, and we started eating more refined carbohydrates. So all this great number of new products came out from food companies with low fat and no fat and all of this. But the refined carbohydrates that, according to this article, I'm talking to a lot of scientists, may be behind our problems of obesity and diabetic problems, the onset of childhood diabetes and all this. It's too high intake of refined carbohydrates that affect insulin levels, and we're constantly hungry. Nothing satisfies like beef, right? So you need to read this article if you want a little lift, okay? And there's been a real problem in getting National Research Council, or not National Research Council, NIH, or other types of funding to follow this up, this research, because everybody, that became dogma that animal fat was the problem, and therefore you couldn't get a grant to actually study whether some other approach might be better. And so maybe this will open the door to more studies to reevaluate this whole issue of diet and obesity.
Now, I think these are still out there in terms of heart disease and cancer and the role of animal fat. But then that gets more complicated. They get into the whole issue of LDH and LDLs and HDLs and those ratios and how that relates to eating animal products versus vegetables and the mixture of two and so on and so forth. So there's a lot more to be found out about the whole issue of diet and health. And it looks to me like the whole issue of fat and whether we should produce more fat animals. First of all, people have to eat it and they have to buy it and we sell what they'll pay the most for. And maybe it ain't all bad. We do eat too much, but maybe it ain't all bad, okay? So that's required reading as far as it's going to be for our students anyway. Okay, so we've got to set the target fat. I don't care whether it's select or whether it's low choice or what it is. You have to know your market. You have to set your target and then compare your contemporaries at that target. So we're comparing apples and apples. If I don't accomplish anything more, I want to make that point. That's been a lot of a problem. We've not compared them at the same endpoint. The reason that we're concerned from a nutritional point of view that you have to set that endpoint, note that each of those grades are related to chemical composition, and the chemical composition is directly related to the energy content gain, which is directly related to feed efficiency. So we have to know what that target endpoint is because we use that to predict what the composition of gain was and therefore the energy cost of that gain to compute their feed required for the observed performance. Okay? So the next thing is we got to understand our target market weight at that composition. What is going to be the window of acceptability for your target composition in terms of weight? You have to know what that is. So you might have cattle that are 20% of 1,500 pounds, but those carcasses are too big. So you have to reject those right away just on that basis, no matter how they stack up in feed efficiency. So you have to figure that out. From our point of view, though, we have to estimate what that finished weight is of that 28% fat low choice grade in order to calculate their apparent feed efficiency from their observed growth rate. Okay, so we have to actually measure that. You have to set the target, but we have to be able to predict that in the growing animals, whether we're going to slaughter them or not. We know that cattle vary considerably in the weight at which they reach a target chemical composition. If our target is 28% fat up here, this is a serial slaughter study of Angus bulls, steers, and heifers. It was done in Holsteins at Cornell way back in '70 by Tom Reed and his group. And notice as the genotype varies, the sex condition varies, the weight at a particular composition varies. And so we've got to be able to know what that weight is going to be at that target composition. And that's one of the biggest challenges we have when we're trying to get at an individual animal's apparent feed requirement and feed efficiency when they're pen fed, is what weight will they be at that target. Now, we published some work back in 10 years ago where we took experimental data where we had chemical composition on cattle, and we came up with some relationships between frame size based on the BIF measurements of hip height and age to compute frame score. And then we related frame score to weight at 28% fat of steers and heifers and then developed an equation to predict weight at 20% fat based on frame size. That's one approach we can use, okay? Now, there are a whole bunch of things, though, that can change this. And so we've come up with a different approach, an alternative approach, but this is one approach, and we're going to show you some data in a little bit that isn't too bad. It does work reasonably well as a place to start to get at the 20% fat weight, the low choice weight. One of the things that will influence that weight, we assume an estrogenic implant in a two-phase feeding program in setting those targets. But we know that if you winter the cattle in background before you finish them, it can add 5 to 10% to the weight at 20% fat. And then high grain feeding from weaning to 20% fat will reduce the weight to 20% fat by 5 to 10%. And so you've got to make some adjustments here. We're just going through a whole bunch of adjustments then we have to make when we're measuring these cattle as they grow in the feedlot to calculate energy content of gain and feed efficiency. We have to account for these things. We just published a paper summarizing a lot of data on use of implants. And we know we go all the way from estrogenic alone in one implant all the way to very aggressive implant programs. And our analysis indicates that in steers, we can take an animal that would, with no implant, would finish at 20% fat at 1145 and would be 1237, that same steer, if you use an aggressive implant. Let's say estrogen with Revlor and so on, with the various combinations. That we can shift that animal 92 pounds and their weight at 20% fat. And that's a lot of the reason why a lot of our cattle, of course, haven't graded as well, because we haven't recognized this shift and taken into account of what we do when we... And you take that implant strategy and superimpose it on an animal of already large mature size, and look what happens. Okay? So it's no wonder our weights have shifted. Our implant strategy got more aggressive, our cattle type has gotten bigger, and all of a sudden we got these outside carcasses. In terms of feedlot heifers, you can shift them just like the steers with an aggressive implant strategy. In the same database, we took the heifer data and adjust them all to 20% fat, and we could increase them 85 pounds in the heifers. Now, that really is a good thing, because we can bring the steer size down, we can bring the heifers up, and hit them better within the window of acceptability on carcass. But we do have to take into account in predicting 20% fat weight. So Pavel Gilroy was a graduate student with us, and now a future beef, that worked to develop a new equation to predict this 28% fat from carcass measurements. And we're going further in trying to try to do this with ultrasound, to get out in live animals that we aren't going to slaughter, like bulls and heifers. But it uses the empty body fat percent is a function of fat depth and loin eye area and hot carcass weight and quality grade. And those are measurable under most conditions. You can get that data from carcass data from packing plants. And then we have some preliminary information that indicates that we can, if your ultrasound is done well and done consistently, you can get those same measurements in the live animal and plug them into this equation, and it predicts 20% body fat reasonably well in a growing heifer or bull that we're not going to slaughter. But when we're going to have a progeny test or just feedlot cattle that we're trying to allocate pens to commingled cattle, then we use the carcass measurements to predict 20% fat to figure out where they're at on the growth curve to calculate the energy content of gain. So then we go on from there, and we have equations to calculate empty body weight from shrunk weight. Then we can go from full weight to shrunk weight and so on, and then calculate 20% fat weight as a function of the empty body fat and so on and so forth to get at what that animal's 20% fat weight really was. Regardless of what they were slaughtered at, maybe they were 30% fat when they ended up, we can adjust that back to 28 as our base for low choice to get at what their energy requirements for growth are. Okay, now, accounting, once we have that 20% fat weight, and we know where they're at on the growth curve, a particular weight, the next step is to determine the energy requirements for growth of these different mature-sized cattle. And again, in the short time we have, all I can do is give a quick overview. I'm not going to bore you with a bunch of equations. They wouldn't mean much anyway. And by the way, fortunately, and again, also the reason I was clapping very loud for Dr. Gozzi on this, is we were able to actually put in your hands our paper here at the conference. And all I'm trying to do now is make you aware of what we're doing, and that's all you can hope to do is get a general awareness of this, but you can read the details in the paper. Most of the details are there, okay? But what we've been working for the last, really since about 1975 on a growth model, and it's gone through various evolutions and permutations. But the one we currently use to calculate requirements for growth was published in 1992, and then we've had some updates since then, is the one that was used by the nutrient requirements for beef cattle, and most recently for dairy cattle, is their growth model. Now, what this growth model basically does is what it says is we have two animals, one that's 28% fat or low choice, 1,100 pounds, another one's 1,300 pounds when they're 28% fat. During growth, okay, they're going to be this much different in weight when they're at the same chemical composition. So when they're at 55% of 20% fat weight, this animal's going to weigh 708, this is going to weigh 600. Okay, when this one's 800, this is going to be 944 when they're 73% of that target fat. This one will be 91% of 20% fat. When it's 1,000, this one will be 1180 when it's at that point. Okay, so these, the bigger the mature size of the animal, the heavier they weigh during growth at the same composition. And then this shows down here at a certain percentage of 20% fat weight what the energy content of the gain is. If they're gaining 2 pounds a day, this is the energy content of gain. If they're gaining 4 pounds a day, it's 6.92 mcals per pound of gain at this point. But then you go over here, when they're near finish, look how that goes from 6.9 to 10 megacalories per day at the same growth rate, just simply because they're depositing more fat as they get higher proportion of mature weight, or the 20% fat weight. Okay, so this is what we're taking into account, is the differences in weight at 20% fat and the energy content of gain during the growth. And this is the heartbeat of how we get at feed efficiency, is trying to calculate the energy content of gain from that information. Okay, so the summary of how we approach this then, as I talked about when we started, is the feed for gain is the energy required for gain, which we just saw how we do that, divided by the diet energy content for gain. Feed for maintenance is the energy required for maintenance, and we use body weight during the growth period to calculate that, divided by the diet and energy maintenance value. And then the individual dry matter required is a feed for maintenance plus a feed for gain. For the observed growth rate and the observed body weight then, is just simply feed for maintenance plus feed for gain is the apparent feed consumption of the animal. Then you divide by the growth rate or average daily gain to get at what was the feed conversion. Now notice in here that a key part of this, which we haven't talked about, is the ration energy value. Now one of the flaws in this system, or I'm going to call it a flaw, I'm going to call it a limitation in the system, is we're using energy values for feeds based upon equations that were developed that represent the average of the population. This is what the energy value would be derived out of that feed for maintenance and growth by the average of the population. We have no way that I know of, and maybe Gordy Carson's going to figure this out, is how we can get at what the real net energy value of that ration was for growing individual animal pen fed. We don't really know how they digest and metabolize that. We know that we can get at the composition gains we talked about and their weight, but we don't really know how they metabolize that energy to get to that point. I don't know of a good way to measure that right now, and I hope somebody will figure that out. So we're stuck right now with trying to do the best we can to get at good estimates of the average energy value for those animals on contemporary being fed. Now, there is a critical part of this, though. We did a study, or I should say Luis, one of our team members in his thesis, looked at different ways of coming up with those energy values. And we're just going to caution you about using tabular net energy values out of NRC tables or somewhere else, because they don't necessarily represent the energy value of your feed. Obviously, if alfalfa hay in there has an NEG of 0.24, and your alfalfa hay was a different, or alfalfa silage was a different variety, made a different stage of maturity, it's not going to be that energy value. So the level 2 of the NRC has this model in it that you can use to calculate the energy values of your particular feed using chemical composition of those feeds. And so if you want it to be accurate, we have to go a little further than we've been used to going if we really want to be more accurate in predicting the feed efficiency. Okay, I'm going to quickly go through an example here of how this works. Okay, we want to get at now, again, repeating myself, we want to get at what was the apparent feed intake or an animal share, each individual share of the feed that was fed to a pen of cattle. Okay? What we need to know about that group of animals that we was fed in, or each of the, we need about the group, we need to know the total pen dry matter intake. We need to know the ration formula, the ingredients. We need to have an ingredient analysis on those if we're going to predict accurate net energy values. We need to know some information about the pen if we want to get at how the pen affected their maintenance requirements. We have that in our model to be able to account for activity effects and effects of environment on maintenance requirements and those things. And quite frankly, folks, how an animal is affected by environment is probably one of the most critical things, because we still feed our beef cattle exposed to environment, and we can do a reasonable job of taking a shot at that, of accounting for environmental effects with our model. What we can't take into account is some of the inherent biological differences between breed types. But how they are affected by the environment, I think we can at least get some idea. Okay, and then individual animal, we got to know about their breed, sex. We talked about implant and sex, why that's important to know. The initial weight, the final weight, the frame size, or using carcass weight, marbling, ribeye area, and fat, either directly on the carcass or with ultrasound, get at the 20% fat weight, days on feed, and daily gain. Those are the inputs you need for the model to run it. These we talked about you can do within reason under practical conditions. Here's an example calculation for an Angus steer. This is an actual Angus steer, and we know this was from one of our studies. Had a daily gain of 4.64 pounds a day. I just wanted to impress you that we do grow some good Angus in New York, okay? This was one from our Cornell herd. I have to brag about that. Gained 4.64 pounds a day. Initial weight is 713. And his 28% fat weight was actually 1,241 pounds. And I can't remember whether we did it with carcass or we did both ultrasound carcass. We can't remember. We came up with 20% fat weight of 1,241. Final weight was actually 1,265. Now notice that he would have been fat at 1,241, but he actually finished at 1,265. So his real 20% fat weight or low choice grade was really this. Because rarely would you ever hit it exactly on the target when you mark as this animal. You know retrospectively what they would have been. Then we got the heart carcass weight, days on feed, quality grade, ribeye area, back fat. Plug those in our equation to come up with our 20% fat weight. The diet metabolizable energy value we developed with our model from feed analysis of feeds and used the environmental information, so on and so forth. And what we come up with here then is a diet and energy value for growth. The diet and energy gain required for this animal growing from 713 to 1241 to 20% fat. We said the average energy content of the gain was 10.82 megacalories, so the parent feed for gain required was 17.64. Diet and energy maintenance value was this, taking the mean body weight during the feeding period. We come up with a feed required for maintenance, and then the total feed requirement is the sum of feed for maintenance plus growth. And then the feed required divided by daily gain is the feed efficiency of 5.42. Now, biologically, we know there are some limitations in this. We used an average energy value. Again, we don't know what the real energy value derived out of the feeds of those animals were. We don't know how to measure that at this point. But it does give us some reasonable number. What we have accounted for are differences in body size and differences in composition of gain. Those are the major things that we're able to account for. But now, how much of the variation does those two variables really account for? Well, we'll show you some analysis that we did. This is 365 individually fed steers over a period of years at Cornell where we had actual body composition where we individually fed them. We knew the energy values of the feed pretty accurately. And this is the observed dry matter consumed versus the predicted dry matter required by our model. And we count for 74% of the variation with a very small bias, typically less than 1% in the studies of which we looked at. So we count for 74% of the variation in the actual feed those animals ate. And then when we computed the feed efficiency, divided the feed intake by gain, we account for 82% of the differences in feed efficiency. And what we're really saying then is there's another 18% that we're not accounting for in the variation that's due to differences probably in inherent differences in how they metabolize the energy for maintenance and for growth or the inherent maintenance requirement differences. But we got the big hunk, 82% of it. So it's a place to start. That's all I'm trying to say. It's a place to start. I think it's better than just taking daily gain and using that alone to figure allocate costs in group in pit-fed animals and a number of other approaches that we do take. At least we've accounted for the major variables here that influence the energy required and the feed consumed. Okay, that's the major point here. Now, in terms of selection, amongst those individually fed 365 steers, there was quite a lot of variation in feed-to-gain ratio. And so it sure looked like there was an opportunity here to select for some differences. There certainly were a distribution of feed efficiencies among those animals. Now, another thing that comes up is I commingle these cattle with different owners in a pen because you end up sorting cattle and end up with different owners in a pen in a lot of these feed out programs. Am I being billed fairly for my share of the feed? Well, I always think my cattle are more efficient and I got billed too much. What we found in analysis of our data is as long as you have somewhere at least 5 animals to 6 animals per owner in a pen, that your likelihood of being billed wrong is less than probably 1 to 2%. So if you're feeding, looking at one animal, yes, you can be quite a bit off. But the risk of error of being billed wrong is down 1-2% as long as you have at least 5 animals per owner in a pen. Okay, this is some data provided by Dr. Matt Cravey, Microbeef Technologies of cattle that they through their AccuTrack system. The bottom line is what Matt found, and these were cattle fed over the course of a year, and I believe Decatur County feed yard, and the bias of apparent feed required versus the actual feed that disappeared in the pens that these cattle were fed in was less than 1%. And so this was indicates that it is possible to use this on a commercial basis to allocate feed. Okay, now we got one final thing to cover here in a very short time. And that is, okay, in all the data I showed you in the validation data, those cattle weren't necessarily being compared over the same stage of growth. We accounted for their actual energy content and gain during the evaluation, but they weren't necessarily, they had different initial weights, okay? They started on feed at different times, and some of them were more than 20% fat, some less than 20% fat when we finished. And so we have to go a step further with this, and we have to be able to adjust all these cattle so we're comparing them over the stage, same stage of growth. Let's say from 60% to 100% of 20% fat weight, or 80 to 100%, or whatever, so that we're over the same stage of growth when we're trying to make comparisons. Let's just take two steers. One, they both had 20% fat weight of 1,200. But this one had initial weight of 500 post-weaning. This one had initial weight of 700 when we put them on feed post-weaning. Okay, we measured the last 58% of the growth period on this one. We measured the last 42% of the growth period on this one. And this one had an average fat content of the gain higher, or energy content of the gain higher, average during the feeding period than what this one did. If we look here at the average NEG required for growth, because this one started at an earlier stage of growth, was about 5.99, this was 6.87 energy content of the gain during growth. So this one had a poorer feed efficiency, but maybe not, okay, because it was at a different stage of growth. So we're not comparing apples and apples again. So after all the other stuff we did, we still got to go a step further to truly evaluate these animals so we compare apples and apples. So we built a little model nested within this, our value discovery program, to get at this. We call this a day step model. And what it does is you set your end point, your 20% fat weight, and then what it does is it starts your initial weight and predicts their daily gain each day, accumulates that gain, and then it predicts their body composition as they grow. And then when they hit that target of 28% fat, we'll know what that is, and then it'll compute when they were at 60% of that point, or 80%, whatever we set as our limits, and then we can compare the feed efficiency during those stages of growth using this model, okay? So I don't have time to really go into detail. I'm just trying to give you the idea of what this does. Among other things, it's used to predict break-even price of cattle as they grow, what your accumulated cost is at any point in composition and grade, those sorts of things. But in terms of selection and use to compare differences in feed efficiency, we feel like this is a very critical part of this. Now, when we took this day step model on a subgroup of individually fed cattle and we predicted their observed feed efficiency with the model predicted feed efficiency, where we predict their daily growth and accumulated weight on a daily basis, we accounted for 83% of the variation in feed efficiency, the same as our feed allocation model we talked about earlier. I won't go into the details of the complicated sum of the difference, but we did validate it, and it seemed to work fairly well. So then we went on, and we tried to look at the difference, whether or not when we use the same stage of growth efficiency, SRU feed efficiency, okay, when we compared them over the same stage of growth, If those cattle were all at the same stage of growth, this line would be straight and all the points would be on the same line. But they were not. That we only account for 72% of the variation, which means that those animals were not all at the same stage of growth. Therefore, we needed to make this adjustment, okay? Here's another interesting thing we looked at. When we compared over the same stage of growth, just using growth per body weight, 3/4 power, or metabolic body weight, just growth alone, compared over the same stage of growth, gave us about the same R squared, about 70% of the variation, as what this approach did. And so this may be a simpler approach that needs to be explored further. But we've been looking at some different ways to try to get at this indirectly through our modeling work, and those are some things. The last thing I'm going to show you is we looked at this issue of residual feed intake. Since we had all of the individual intakes of these individually fed animals, we could do a residual feed analysis, okay? And so we simply did the regression, predicted daily gain, or predicted dry matter intake using just regressed body weight, average daily gain, dry matter intake to come up with a regression equation, and then you compare each individual animal's actual intake against the regression predicted to see whether above or below average, right? That's roughly what that does, just to give you a simple explanation. This approach over here is looking at the residual, okay, an individual animal's actual intake minus our model required feed intake based on the composition of gain and body weight. And you can see there was less variation where we were using the feed required approach, using composition of gain for each animal and their body weight and so on. It had less variability than this because we're using a generalized regression over all those animals. So we think that accounting for difference in composition of individuals in doing this may actually be a little bit better, and you don't have to individually feed them to do it. Now, that's our very quick interpretation, folks. I could be wrong, but this was our initial analysis. Luis, you're up to straighten this out if I got it wrong, because he did all the work on this. Okay, last thing is show you how we apply this to breeding bulls. Okay, this is our New York State bull test, which Mike Baker runs each year at Cornell, and with individual owners just like other bull tests around the country. And what we did is simply evaluated these bulls last year for feed efficiency with this value discovery model. And I'm going to show you two things. One is how much variation there was amongst these bulls using this model. Secondly, when we take the total feed they all ate, okay, did the sum of their feed requirements calculated with the model agree with what the total was that disappeared? Because we always do that validation to see if our inputs are right, to see whether our model is set right, and whether it's really accurate or not, and because the sum of the individual feed requirements should come pretty close to what actually disappeared to the whole pen. Okay? So if we look down here at the feed efficiency of these bulls, there's our feed required computed by the model. We got pounds of dry matter divided by daily gain gives our feed conversion of 668 was the average, but the minimum is 581 to 753. And remember, this is adjusted for difference in composition of mature weight and all those variables we talked about, and there was still a fair amount of variation in feed efficiency amongst those bulls. That's the point here. And there were some other measures of efficiency we're looking at. On the last slide on this is that when we took the total feed that was fed during the whole test and we compared it with our feed allocation model or day-step model, and with or without using ultrasound to predict carcass composition or using frame score to predict 20% fat weight, they all gave about the same answer. In other words, we were able to predict our feed required agreed with in total for all those bulls with the actual that disappeared what they actually were fed. Okay, and that's our check. So we're doing some more work on breeding bulls. We're doing some slaughter work with bulls. We're actually measuring their composition to do some more validation of this of the use of this on breeding bulls. Conclusions, I think this approach can account for over 80% of the variation and differences among cattle and feed efficiency. At least that's what our data suggests, if we can get the measurement, the inputs accurately enough. There's some unaccounted for variation that we have to get at. We need the research tools tools out there that identify that we can use on the farm to get at differences in metabolic efficiency that cannot easily be measured now that I'm aware of. Last thing I'm going to mention is we do
have the software finished now, and we're in a beta test stage. And if you are interested in using this for your own feed bull test on your farm or feed out program or whatever, if you want to start playing with it, then the best thing to do is just mlc44@cornell.edu.
Pop us an email.
If you're interested, and it lets you use it something like 30 times before you have to decide whether you want to buy the thing or not. And we're just at the beta test stage, so we aren't going to release it generally to everybody for a while. We're going to work with some beta testers to check it on some other data and let them use it.
And that's all I have to say. Thank you, Joe.